Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, the show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Adrienne Boise, Chief Experience Officer of the Cleveland Clinic. She's presiding over the 10th Annual Patient Experience Summit, which brings together experts from across the health industry, hospital administrators, clinicians, and patient advocates, examining the need to develop better empathy training for clinicians in healthcare. Lori Robertson also checks in, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea. It's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Adrienne Boise, Chief Experience Officer at the Cleveland Clinic, here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Adrienne Boise, Chief Experience Officer of the Cleveland Clinic Health System. She's a neurologist and staff physician in the Cleveland Clinic Mellon Center for Multiple Sclerosis. Dr. Boise also leads the Center for Ethics, Humanities, and Spiritual Care. She previously served as Medical Director of the Center of Excellence in Healthcare Communication and currently serves as Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Patient Experience. She earned her Master's in Bioethics from Case Western Reserve, her medical degree from Penn State University College of Medicine, and completed her neurology residency and fellowship at Cleveland Clinic. Dr. Boise, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks for having me.
And I see that you're presiding over the 10th Annual Patient Experience Summit, the largest independent patient experience summit in the world. You know, it's kind of interesting that the 10 years really connects back to when the advent of the cell phone came out, and we've seen this explosion in technical innovations driving challenges in healthcare over the past decade. But in some ways, it's leading to more loss of empathy in our healthcare system, which you say harms patients' experience. And I'm wondering if you could talk to our listeners about the evolution of the science of patient experience and why empathy plays such an important role.
Well, you know, patient-centered care really emerged as a concept over decades. And it started really way back when the Institute of Medicine had published a report. It was called The Crossing of the Quality Chiasm. Mm-hmm. And they talked about six efforts that healthcare needed to make healthcare more efficient, safe, equitable, and more patient-centered. And they defined it at that time as care that's respectful of the patient preferences, needs, and values, and ensuring those values guide clinical decisions. And we've come a long way since then, but there's still a lot of work to do. You know, if you research even the number of studies on empathy or patient-centeredness specifically, you come up with about 1,800 articles since the 1960s. And yet, I still hear stories at times from journals not accepting articles that are focused on the patient experience because they don't think it's scientific enough. And that's pretty worrisome, as you're seeing decades and decades of literature coming out that talk about the power and the impact empathy and real conversations can have on patient-reported outcomes, medical outcomes, safety, quality, experience. And so we need to get real that it's not this soft thing, but it is backed by decades of science. And so I think we still have some work to do there. I hope we get out of the space where we're talking about it as though it doesn't have evidence base.
In a recent TED Talk, you expressed some concern that the empathy, which we believe is so powerful, is perhaps too often dismissed as a soft skill in healthcare, and particularly within medicine that you're seeing this. You've said that empathy needs to be operationalized. Empathy and operationalization don't necessarily go together hand in hand, but I understand where you're coming from as part of their goal of achieving excellence. So tell us what you've learned in your own practice at Cleveland Clinic about the importance of empathy in connecting with your patients and their families, and in particular, maybe the measurable impact empathy has had and is having on patient outcomes. And how do you bake this empathy into your training protocols for your providers and your staff there?
So it is true. I mean, even the fact that you're still hearing empathy called a soft skill drives me kind of crazy. It's not a soft skill. It is the hardest skill that we do as clinicians. And having sat in conversations with patients, you know, telling someone you've never met and you're meeting in the first time in the ER that they have ALS, or telling a patient who thinks they have one diagnosis that in fact they have another. These are not soft conversations. These are exceptionally uncomfortable, and they're intimate, and they're fragile, and you can't wing it. So when you're asking me about my own practice and what really brought this to the forefront for me, I was seeing patients in a very busy practice. I was double booked. And I would meet new patients, and I would do my best to be empathic, but trying to be efficient with time as well. And in many situations, actually a couple bubbled up wherein I was trying to have a conversation about their medical care, and I realized that the patients, I'm a multiple sclerosis specialist, and the patients I was seeing, some of them didn't actually have MS. And so I started to dig into that, and I wanted to be a good neurologist. So I was honest with them right out of the gates, and I said, you know, the great news is you don't actually have MS. And instead of getting the big hug that I thought I would get, they got really mad. And what I realized in that was they weren't looking so much for me to get the diagnosis right. They were actually looking for me to see them in their totality as a human. And the label of MS meant a lot to them. It became an identity. And what was underneath that was, even though they didn't actually have MS, they had suffering. So here was all this suffering that we had neatly applied a label to. What I was actually doing was ripping out their identity. So it taught me that people need to be seen as a human. They need to be known. They need to be understood before they'll trust you with making a significant change like that. And so now I spend a lot more time up front. I actually lay a lot of foundation for our relationship. I empathize. I ask about trauma and how they're coping with the disease before I dive into any of the medical jargon and specifics. And that has changed my practice.
I was just thinking about the challenges in primary care of how, as you say, to connect with the human sitting across from you with suffering. And it seems like you mentioned, you know, the challenges of someone being double booked, also the economy of a practice. You might be in there for 15 minutes with a patient. You've got an EHR in front of you. Your colleagues are burning out, and you're trying to see this patient in his or her totality. And, you know, obviously you're going to need additional set of tools, perhaps, and technology seems to be playing an increasing vital role in that quest. And, you know, at Cleveland Clinic, you've launched a number of efforts to improve patient engagements. And we're just wondering how technology and online social networks like Patients Like Me help improve this patient engagement, which needs more than just the clinician to be engaged.
Yeah. You know, when we talk about engagement, I think we have to be really careful about what we're talking about, because people use that term a lot, and it's used interchangeably, even with experience, and they're not the same thing. One of my favorite examples is, you know, you can go out and ride a roller coaster. You can have the experience of riding a roller coaster, and you could be screaming, throwing your hands up as you're going down the hills, and then buy the photograph afterward. Or you just sit there with your hands crossed and go through the ride. One person on that ride is really engaged with the experience, and the other is not. And so engagement is about engagement with something. A lot of people use these patient portals as an example to say, oh, well, the patient's engaged because, you know, our hospital has patient engagement because 30% of our patients use the patient portal. But if you've never actually logged in to check your labs that are available to you in the portal, we're not maximizing what patient engagement is supposed to be. And so I think to get to truly engaged patients, it's really about behavior, to take maximum benefit from the resources available to them to manage their health, which means they should be completing an advanced directive. They should know what meds they're on and why. Real tangible behaviors that a patient can make to demonstrate engagement. But to fully empower a patient, to get to an engaged patient, healthcare has a responsibility to give them some capabilities back, like access to their data, speedy access to appointment, transparency of costs, availability of their records anytime, anywhere, and really control. You know, consumers have control. Patients don't. And they also have fear, which will forever differentiate them. Mm-hmm. Patients like me, you know, started as a, because one of the brothers of the Haywood family got, right, was diagnosed with ALS. Right. And they were struck by the paucity of resources available for patients. And so they developed Patients Like Me. It's an organization, and there are many others like it, that are trying to create communities, right, where healthcare can't go, because those are patients who have the same disease connecting with those patients. Mm-hmm. In some sense, is the empathy community, mm-hmm, right? Because no one else knows what it's like to live with your disease. And so it's, I think, done a beautiful job in terms of elevating that. They've also been very effective at being transparent, mm-hmm, about how they use patient data, which is a hot topic these days, yep, and that they sell the data, that the data can be used for research. And patients with that level of transparency clearly resonate with it. So I think that's why you're seeing the explosion of spaces like that.
Well, Dr. Boise, it would seem we cannot hardly pick up a journal without reading about clinician burnout, reports that it's at an all-time high, and some pretty devastating consequences to those individuals. And, of course, that has a impact on their patients. You know, Cleveland Clinic has such a great reputation as a high-performing health system, but I doubt immune to those same stressors. What have you done there that we might all learn from that you think is having or has had an impact on preventing, preferably, or reducing clinician burnout? Are there programs that you found to be particularly effective or strategies in preventing or reducing burnout, which one would think would have the net effect of also allowing people to be more empathetic and fully present for their patients?
So we've cared about burnout for some time, but I really learned about it the most when we were launching communication skills training for clinicians. And in the training, all of a sudden you had these small groups of clinicians who began sharing this vulnerability in this safe space that we had created. They began sharing these stories that just made it incredibly hard to imagine how they show up for work the next day. And it struck me at the time that what was therapeutic about the training wasn't necessarily that we were doing reflective listening or anything, but that we were creating a space for those stories to be told, not judged, just held. And the sensation of what it feels like to have empathy reflected to you. And when you do that, the clinicians never forget it. We hold them accountable for patient satisfaction scores and tell them to be more empathic. But who's being empathic to them? And that question drove everything we developed since then. Mm-hmm. So we've taken a three-prong approach, and it's important to note that burnout is not an individual problem. It's about the system. Something about the healthcare system is not supporting these amazing clinicians to be their best. And so these individual fixes, like resilience courses for me, as you've heard me talk about, mm-hmm, you know, resilience courses for me or yoga training, that is a bit offensive because I studied minutiae for years to become a doc. I studied physics even when I knew I'd never use it again in clinical practice. Mm-hmm. And so we need to acknowledge and make sure we're talking about the system and how the system can change. I spoke about a lot of solutions. Many of them seem like common sense, having pharmacists do refills for patients who are already established, having pharmacists help with pre-authorization or some of the paperwork that often clinicians get left to do, implementing scribes and virtual scribes so that we're not just typists. I think in terms of programmatic things, we also have to look in healthcare when you were talking about empathy operationalized. So some of the things that we've done, which other organizations could easily do, would be to recognize the moments that matter for clinicians and patients. Jonathan Bartels out of University of Virginia came up with this beautiful concept, the pause, which is just to take a breath when a patient dies, right? A ritual called the pause. Take a moment and recognize the power you have. We've begun honor walks, So when a patient donates their organs, all of the caregivers line up in the hallways to honor that patient and the sacrifice they're making to save other lives. When there's a trauma in our ER or somebody is hurt, you can call a code Lavender, and a team from our office will arrive on the unit to provide care to the caregivers. We set them up for success by making sure they do have those spaces where they can be vulnerable. So I think it's about attentiveness to the moments where you can create meaning, because burnout is associated with the loss of meaning for people. You have these amazing people that want to be caring and healing, and then we make it so hard for them to do that. We have to get out of their way. You hear a lot of talk about the EHR. I would say it's not the EHR per se. It's the lack of intuitiveness, that it's not making my job any easier, right? It's taking two extra hours to document at nighttime.
Lots of clicks.
I wouldn't mind the clicks, quite honestly, if it helped me do what I'm there to do. But how does the EHR help me understand what's most important to the patient, right? That goes back to the beginning. We're talking about patient-centered care and empathy. I haven't met an EHR that does that yet. You wouldn't get so much frustration if I saw the reward of a deeper connection with the patient I'm trying to impact and walk on their journey with.
We're speaking today with Dr. Adrienne Boise, Chief Experience Officer of the Cleveland Clinic Health System. She's a neurologist and staff physician at the Cleveland Clinic Mellon Center for Multiple Sclerosis. You've already talked about the work that you've been doing on communication skills for physicians, and it really came out of the Cleveland Clinic's own experience with misdiagnosis, medical errors, even deaths a few years ago after they reviewed thousands of patients' concerns and complaints about communication between patients and clinicians. And you've really sort of talked about developing those core skill sets for providers and recognizing that the health system itself has to do some things to make sure that there's access to data, access to appointments, there's transparency of costs. I'm wondering, in your 10th conference, have you segued over to sharing some of this with group practices, smaller entities than the hospital systems, if there's any training protocols you've developed that might assist those clinicians in becoming better communicators? Because they're really a different set of problems.
You know, about a decade ago at the Cleveland Clinic, Toby had declared us patients first, and he had elevated the first chief experience officer in the country to represent patient experience at the executive team. And we didn't quite know what to do with that either. And one of the first things we did was develop service recovery training, Respond with Heart. And that was for 40,000 people. We put them all in a room over a year and a half. We trained them in that. And there's a great Harvard Business Review article on the service recovery paradox, that this is one of the skill sets that healthcare doesn't have. And what we realized from that, though, was that the conversations clinicians had can't really be fixed by models that work in hospitality. So if I smile and say thank you or my pleasure, that feels very superficial to most clinicians. And so we wanted to evolve communication skills training that works on, it's called the READY model framework, relationship establishment, development, engagement. How do you do that? What does that sound like? They might try to start fixing the problem, and then they think that's empathy, and it's not empathy. Empathy is simply meeting the emotion where it is in that other person and taking the time to do that. So we've taken that training. We've trained about 9,000 clinicians as well as across the globe. So we certainly are happy to share that model. You know, empathy doesn't take much time. Like, how long does a hug take? How long does a touch on the hand take? It takes seconds. And so oftentimes you hear buzzwords of, you know, empathy in 15 seconds or 30 seconds. And the truth of the matter is if you're doing it, time stops. And even if you had 15 minutes, that 1 minute will be something the patient will never forget.
You know, you're trying to share this with so many people. You're presiding over the Patient Experience Summit. You've got an improvisation coach from the famous Second City comedy troupe. You have a fellow named Chris Dancy, who's been called the most connected man on earth, really focused on how technology gadgets can improve health. But I think my favorite of these is your event called Death Over Dinner, where attendees join together for a meal and a really frank conversation about how do we address death and dying with our patients. Talk a little bit about the variety of presenters. What are you most excited about?
We are really excited about the 10th year, and especially imagining clinicians and a healthcare organization teaming up with health IT. We always begin and end the conference with patients. That's a non-negotiable for us. Actually, when the conference started almost a decade ago, we had Charity Tilghman Dick come, who recently passed. She was the opera singer who had a double lung transplant twice. She sang beautifully about 10 years ago, and then it's unfortunate that now here we are 10 years later, but having just recently passed. So it's trying to literally elevate voices like hers that are messaging both the profound beauty of empathy and the power that it can have. Death Over Dinner is the brainchild of a wannabe architect. His name is Michael Hebb. And he came with this idea many years ago around how do you get people, and he's done this for Barack Obama and many other sort of high-profile events, where people came together over a table, which was the piece that interested him as an architect, to have really important conversations in an era where everybody's got a phone. Are we still talking to each other about the things that matter most? And we have collaborated with him to develop a Death Over Dinner for Healthcare, meaning if you as a healthcare provider could have this conversation over dinner about your own imagining and dreams for your life and the end of your life, could you then be a more effective enabler of a conversation with a patient? I think it's very powerful. We're going to expose people to the concept of the conversation with death over dinner. So clearly people are looking for real meaning. And I mean, the event is most exciting for me because actually when I started this work a decade ago, I felt actually quite alone. Sometimes it feels really hard to keep pushing to amplify empathy in today's world. There's always something newer in technology that's coming. And how do you keep saying this stuff matters? And I think when the movement was first starting almost a decade ago, it just felt lonely for me. Mm-hmm. And so this event, when you're staring at the thousands of people that are coming together to elevate this global conversation, I feel a little less lonely.
Thank you so much for speaking today with us, Dr. Boise, Chief Experience Officer at the Cleveland Clinic Health System. And you can learn more about her work by going to clevelandclinic.org, or you could follow her on Twitter at B-O-I-S-S-Y-A-D. Dr. Boise, thank you so much for advancing the quest to build empathy and better communications into our profession and for your commitment to innovation in care delivery to improve the patient experience, and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Oh, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke advocated universal background checks for gun purchases, claiming that state laws mandating universal checks, quote, have been shown to reduce gun violence by 50%. But academic research doesn't support that. O'Rourke's campaign said the statistic came from Every Town for Gun Safety, but the gun control group told us it has updated its background material on the issue in light of rigorous new research. A study published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine in March found that universal background checks are associated with about a 15% reduction in firearm homicide. The study looked at homicide and suicide rates in all 50 states over a 26-year period and analyzed the relationship between various firearm laws, including universal background checks. But the study stopped short of concluding that the decline was caused by those laws. Federal law requires background checks on those who buy guns from federally licensed firearm dealers. There have been attempts in Congress to require universal checks, which would cover private sales by unlicensed individuals, including some sales at gun shows and over the internet, but the policy has failed to gain enough support to pass. Research released by Everytown in 2015 found, quote, nearly 50% fewer police murdered with guns, women shot to death by intimate partners in states with background checks. But determining that states with universal background checks have lower rates of certain types of violence is not the same as proving that universal background checks have been shown to reduce gun violence by 50%, the phrase used by O'Rourke. David Hemingway, director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center and the Harvard Youth Violence Prevention Center, told us it is notoriously difficult for researchers to tease out the effects of various gun policies in states that often have a combination of policies. A 2017 paper Hemingway co-authored reviewed the available peer-reviewed research on gun control laws from 1970 to 2016. It, quote, found evidence that stronger firearm laws are associated with reductions in firearm homicide rates. But a reduction in violence of 50%, quote, seems much, much too high to me, Hemingway told us. And that's my Fact Check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Sub-Saharan Africa leads the world in maternal and infant deaths each year. According to an annual report from Save the Children, an estimated 397,000 babies died at birth in that region in 2013, and some 550 mothers died per day as well. Most of the causes have to do with lack of access to medical care in these low-resource regions, and often the local midwives lack formal medical training to prepare them to conduct interventions in the event of a life-threatening event like a hemorrhage or an infection.
We know that 90% of all the deaths that we see today could be prevented if the mother had access to this, really basic skill care during the childbirth.
Anna Frelin is CEO of the Maternity Foundation. Their organization has created an intervention for midwives living in low-resource areas. It's called the Safe Delivery App, and it provides comprehensive training for midwives that teach them and guide them on what to do in the event of a birthing crisis.
This is really a matter of building the skills of the health workers who are already out there and empower them to be able to better handle the emergencies that, may occur during a childbirth, such as, the woman starts bleeding or the newborn is not breathing and so forth. So first and foremost, it's a matter of finding a way that we can reach the health workers and build their skills.
Frelin says the real promise of the Safe Delivery application lies in its ability to provide ongoing obstetric and neonatal training. The Safe Delivery app has been designed to be culturally relevant and easily understood, and it's received the United Nations approval for wider deployment. The Maternity Foundation plans to have the Safe Delivery app in the hands of 10,000 healthcare workers across the region by next year, a low-cost, culturally sensitive mobile app that offers immediate guidance and assistance to midwives and health workers, empowering them with ongoing support and knowledge that can improve birth outcomes. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.